From the Sky News Centre at 5, a man's been found guilty of murdering a vulnerable schoolgirl in 2007. A jury decided Robert Ewing, who's 60, killed 15-year-old Paige Chivers in his Blackpool flat. Another man, 46-year-old Gareth Dewhurst, also from the town, was convicted of helping dispose of her body, which has never been found. Here's Detective Superintendent Andy Webster.
It is almost 8 years since Paige disappeared, and she's never been found. And to this end, I remain committed to finding her. And I would appeal to Robert Ewing and Gareth Dewhurst to tell us now where she is so she can be laid to rest with dignity.
British holidaymakers are returning from Tunisia after the government changed travel advice.
It's just very, very disappointing.
We never felt threatened at all.
The Foreign Office thinks more terror attacks are highly likely and says you should only go if the trip's essential. Police Scotland have apologised after not following up a report of a car crash that left a man dead and a woman seriously injured. The 25-year-old was taken to hospital when she was eventually found on Wednesday morning, despite the initial incident on the M9 near Stirling on Sunday. Actor Omar Sharif has died from a heart attack at the age of 83. He's best known for films including Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia. A temporary control zone is being set up around a poultry farm in Lancashire after a suspected case of bird flu was discovered. All birds will be culled to limit the risk of the disease spreading. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
Saturday Breakfast here on BCFM 93.2 FM 8.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we've been told to take a 2 week break at the Politics Show because the Harbour Festival is on next Friday. So we'll be back in a fortnight, but we'll also take a longer view tonight of the rise of the police state here in Britain. Blogger and broadcaster with the internet radio station 21st Century Wire, Basil Valentine joins us to take a look at the shutdown of investigative journalism in Britain and the slow erosion of the civil liberties since the 2005 London bombings here in Britain. Following on from that, investigative journalist, privacy campaigner and author of two absolutely must-have books for your car glove box, Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World? Kevin Cahill will be here to bring us the latest on his legal action against the internet titans like Microsoft. There's news, too, this week of child sexual abuse cover-up at Prince Charles, Prince Edward and Prince Andrew's school, Gordonston, in the Scottish Islands. All the interviews with former pupils have disappeared, say the police, and they can't question the master doing the abusing either because he's gone and died in a car crash. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs at 21 degrees Celsius, sunnier on Saturday, cloudier with some showers though on Sunday. Next week, temperatures high around 21 Celsius, mainly cloudy week with plenty of showers. Next weekend, 18th and 19th of July, highs of 21 degrees and mainly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. After a bit of a long break, Anthony, I should apologise, really. Should have invited you back a bit earlier. But anyway, welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks. I thought it was something I said.
No, usually if you're saying something controversial, Anthony, you're much more likely to be invited back quickly. I ought to say, of course, that from the sort of Westminster political point of view, August is a no-go month and the House will be rising 21st of July and coming back 7th of September this year. But anyway, here in Bristol, do we have a similar break for our politicians?
Well, we're used to it. It seems that that isn't happening now. I've got meetings through August, and that used to be a month where everything went very, very quiet.
So what are you people supposed to take a holiday at a different time of year, or why is that? Has that a change since the mayor came in?
I think it has been changing over the last few years. I don't know if the mayor had a particular a role in that, but this year seems particularly. I have a lot of meetings this August, which is pretty unusual.
Can you make them all?
Oh, I always do my best to make all the meetings, yes.
Okay. What about, because you were on the cabinet, weren't you,
in
the previous administration before the mayor came along. Now, I suppose you're bound to be a bit disgruntled about not having the reins of the city's budget anymore, but how do you think the transition has gone over to the mayor?
When we were setting the budget as the majority party, we opened it up to all councillors, and we had meetings with councillors, questioning sessions, we brought officers in, and really gave all councillors a chance at as early as possible in the formulation of budget to get it right. Nowadays, of course, we just hear the budget announced, although it is now a three-year budget, which I've always favoured, and I think that's a good thing, but it suddenly appears, and there's very little opportunity to do anything apart from gloss it, really. You can't really fundamentally change it.
So that sounds, that's part of the course. Back in the old days, the cabinet had the executive power. Now it's just in one man, the mayor.
Well, the rules are that the authority that the mayor has should have been exactly the same as the authority that the leader of the council had operating a cabinet system. The mayor has taken the biggest, most powerful range of options that he could under the settlement, as it were, and he's also interpreted it to mean that he makes all the decisions. When I was in the cabinet, I can tell you I very often lost decisions within the cabinet, and all of us had a very, very combative time amongst friends within the cabinet, making sure we finessed policy and got it right. I don't think the mayor enjoys that sort of support, and certainly doesn't ask for it.
But surely you were all of one party, weren't you, as a cabinet? He's just one man.
Yes, but that I have found over the six and a bit years I've been a councillor that I've been able to work very successfully with members of other party that actually, you know, believe in the bigger picture and trying to get things right. So I've never had problems crossing parties in that, dealing with other parties in that respect. The mayor does want to keep everything unto himself. And it's the old joke that you should have a committee of an odd number of people as far as the mayor is concerned, and three is too many.
We elected a kind of temporary dictator, didn't we, in a way? So surely that's, again, I mean, what I'm trying to say is now, part of electing a mayor and part of the referendum to have a mayor in Bristol was we were fed up with all the arguments that were going on between individual councillors. Now it's all in one person's hands.
The only time that there was political wrangling was in full council, which there were 10 a year in the council. The rest of the time, when we're working on committees, when we're working alongside each other for ward problems and bigger issues across the city, all the parties work together, or certainly the people that really wanted to work together to get things done. I think, in fact, politics has broken out far more since the mayor has been in, because the mayor is a single person political party, and he's up for re-election in a year's time, and he's obviously got to steer things to make sure that he has the best shot at that when it comes up.
Now, a lot of people are saying, well, there's actually really no point in electing councillors because you don't really have any power anymore.
Within our ward, certainly, we have I don't know about power, but we certainly have a massive responsibility. And I think if that responsibility is played out well within and amongst the community, then we can maximise the amount of energy that we get out of the local community to solve problems. And I think a lot of that does rally around the councillors, but also around the neighbourhood partnerships and other community leaders as well. I think the rest of the real business, I mean, I'm this year now chair of one of the scrutiny committees, and a lot of the real business about checking how things are done and trying to improve them is done cross-party in committees, and we work pretty well together.
It, I mean, isn't quite a lot of our money, because that's really what this is about, our money being spent now by organisations which are really one step removed from councillors, that even though it's public money, even though it's connected with the City Council. I'm thinking about things like the Local Enterprise Partnership, spending millions of public money. I'm thinking about also the Bristol Energy Company, which I think you've been bringing up recently. I think it's called the Bristol Energy Company. I'm thinking also about Bristol Green Capital. I'm thinking about the arena. I'm thinking about Metrobus. These kind of big projects that involve the city. It is quite important that that councillors that we elect are on board with all that. Otherwise, there's no point in electing them, surely.
I think you're absolutely right. And we seek to be as involved as possible, because I think our value is that we can bring independence, probably a dirty word in this situation. But we can certainly bring common sense and not party political experience to bear on some of these issues to try and make them as good as they can be. But my belief is that, and it's certainly why I'm the member of the party I am, is that that the more people you get involved in creating and being a part of a decision, the more that decision is likely to be right and balanced, and the more people, the more energy behind it means that it's going to be more acceptable.
Now, you know what the mayor will say? He was saying, well, I was actually elected because you weren't getting things done. Because I'm one person, I can make these things happen.
Well, the mayor's been there, actually he's been there longer than I was in the cabinet, and what was done while I was in the cabinet, not because I was in the cabinet, but while I was there, is still substantially more than the mayor has managed to achieve, so that's absolute nonsense.
What about things like the Metro Bus and the arena, though? Because I know there's some quite serious questions. The mayor seems to like these projects, but there are a lot of councillors saying, well, hang on, we haven't really seen the figures. The figures don't necessarily stack up, so there's no way we can support this. I mean, that's a bit of a strange situation to be in, isn't it?
What we've seen of the figures give us concerns that those are not going to stack up. The arena particularly looks as if the figures are not going to be now what they've been announced as now are not going to be what they're finally going to be. Metrobus seems to be actually removing some of its some of the elements of Metrobus to make the books balanced within the original figure.
I mean,
and we're very concerned about
these leaks this week, supposed leaks anyway, of a draft contract for Metrobus, which bring down the time. I think it was going to be 5 an hour, so that's what, about every 10-12 minutes or so, down to every 20 minutes. Now, hang on a minute, we're putting all this public money into this, but then we're being told, actually, you're going to get a much less service.
Well, I couldn't agree more, but until we actually know exactly what's rumour and what's fact, and it might be some time before we find that out, we can't make a firm comment. But certainly the rumours that we've heard, I've almost certainly heard the same as you have, are very concerning, and we need to flag these up so that people are as aware of it as possible what might be happening to a flagship project.
Well, you know what I'm going to say? You're chair of one of these scrutiny commissions. It's your job.
In fact, the Metrobus is not one that drops into my committee, but it will be the equivalent committee who will be looking at that, and I very much hope they're going to make sure that they get to the bottom of it.
So what kind of things have you been scrutinising there? Have you had trouble actually getting to the facts? Because it is important in a democratic country that you're allowed to actually see what money's being spent.
You're quite
and
right.
Why?
Well, it's the beginning of a new year, so we've only had one meeting so far, and that wasn't a usual one. That was actually a meeting that was done at the same time as cabinet, so we did a commentary on what cabinet were about to decide, and that was on the waste contract, and that being coming back into the custodianship of Bristol City Council for a year until it can be rejigged. But the other ones that I've got in my scrutiny commission, which is neighbourhoods, are libraries. That might be a little bit exciting. I've got the neighbourhood partnerships. We've got parks and green spaces. There's lots of issues around community, which will certainly come out of that. And I'm looking forward to a very lively year.
I bet. What about libraries then? Because for a lot of people who don't have the internet, or actually maybe don't even like the internet, the library is the only place that they can access a lot of services.
I couldn't agree more. I declare an interest in that. I have a local library that I've been personally campaigning for, which is Redland Library in White Ladies Road, which is, believe it or not even in Cotton Ward, it's in Clifton East Ward. But it's our local library, and it's one that's on the threatened list, although the officers, of course, refused to use the term threatened. My guess is that when we hear about what's going on with these libraries, and we're going to have a report in front of our Scrutiny Commission on the 17th of July, and I hope there'll be a lot of interest, a lot of public attending that meeting and seeing what's going on. But my belief is that there will be a genuine attempt to try and keep as many of those seven open as possible, but probably not with the same level of service and opening hours and some of the other things we've come to expect, as was in the past, because obviously a £1.1 million needs to be saved from that budget.
Now, I mentioned this Bristol Energy Company. Can you tell us a bit about it? What is it? What's the point?
Well, the Bristol Energy Company is something that the administration of which I was a member started to put together in 2010, over 5 years ago. And it's the aspirations for that, which is that we could be a municipal energy company, as much as possible developing green, sustainable energy, as much as possible trying to be a local company which respected and looked after those people that were on in fuel poverty, of which there are very many in this city, and also could drive out some profits which we could use and plough back into trying to make our services stretch a little farther than the cuts have succeeded in reducing. And those aspirations are still there, I have to say. But it's taken 5 years to get from that start to where we are now. It all went very quiet just before the mayor was elected. So after the referendum, everything went very quiet for a long time. Offices changed. And for some time after the mayor was elected, and I think that's probably true of lots of services, everything clogged up for some considerable time. We lost a lot of our way on that. What's now happening is that energy company, and that's the shorthand name, it's called the Bristol Energy and Technology Company, as a matter of interest. The setup of this company is also being made very inaccessible. There is going to be one shareholder, which is the City Council, which is all of us, but the person holding that share and using the vote on our behalf is the mayor. And there is it's very difficult to challenge that situation. And I'm very concerned that if we had a mayor that was utterly unscrupulous and wanted to try and, for example, divert funds from the profits of the company to spend on projects which would perhaps affect how people felt about him or her, then there's very little way that we can actually make sure that we can control that situation. And I'm very worried about it. After all, we could have a mayor in the future that was from a particular political party. I mean, we have one from a political party now, but one of the more recognised parties. We could also have a cabinet that was of the same ilk as well. And that would mean that we have very little way of controlling and influencing how this is all run.
But isn't George really a Lib Dem? He was anyway, wasn't he? He was in the Liberal Democrat Party up until just about the time he started his election campaign.
Well, it doesn't look that way to me, and I think you should ask him that rather than me.
Okay. Let's have a look at this week's big news on the budget now. And there's quite a lot of changes. I mean, it'd be possibly pointless to go through them all. But I thought I'd focus today on one aspect of the budget, and that is housing, because this is really, I think, one of the biggest problems in the city for 15,000 or so people registered homeless, trying to use this website, Home Choice Bristol, I think it's called, where you kind of compete to bid for a property or somewhere to live. Obviously, that's not the easiest thing to do if you're homeless. And so I spoke to an expert on housing, Abigail Davis from the Tenant Participation Advisory Service, about it, and this is what she had to say about how her feelings about some of the changes to housing policy. That's to do with building social housing and also making it easy to buy somewhere to live. Yesterday,
I'm Abigail Davis. I'm policy advisor at TPAS. TPAS is a tenant involvement agency, so it helps tenants to be active within their landlords and influence what happens in social housing. So the work that I do is about trying to make sure that tenants' voices are heard within government and within social landlords. This government, more even than the coalition government, is focused on home ownership as a priority. They're talking a little bit about new housing supply, almost exclusively about home ownership. And when they're talking about social housing, which is really the thing that concerns TPAS members, they're looking to put pressure downwards on social housing, really to residualise it and restrict both the access and probably also the living standards of people that tend to live in that housing. So we're very concerned both about the welfare aspects of that and the tenancy security and finances for social landlords.
Well, I don't think anyone has a problem with people being aspirational about owning their own home. The only trouble is, of course, we must be looking around about £200,000 now as an average to buy a home, and obviously a lot more in London. And there are many people whose outgoings actually exceed their income. There's no way they're going to get to the position of being able to afford a mortgage for a £200,000 home.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. One of the things that's got a lot of coverage recently is the right to buy for housing association tenants. And certainly there's probably about a half and half split between tenants as to whether they think this is a good idea or not. And it's absolutely a brilliant opportunity if you're in a position to take it. But as you say, many people are really struggling to buy a home, even with the government-supported programmes. People struggle in the private rented market. So the things that we've been discussing within TPAS are really social housing is a really good product, a really good offer to people that gives them an affordable way to live and a secure, stable, well-managed home. So if it's going to take you years and years to save up to buy, or if you never want to buy, or if you never can, it's a good option for those people.
Well, one of the things that's keeping the house prices up buoyant is quite a lot of migration. I think we've got something like 500,000 people a year coming into Britain, which is obviously going to keep the demand going. Has the budget done anything to address this issue of not enough social rented housing, not enough affordable housing being built?
The budget didn't talk about new supply of affordable housing at all, and that may be in part because the Chancellor's saving something for later. But there is an investment programme for social housing, but what they've actually done by cutting rents that are paid to landlords and also cutting the benefits that are paid to tenants, whether they're in work or not in work, means actually that the incomes that landlords have that they could then spend on building is reduced. So there's been lots of concern amongst tenant members, even those who would see their rents being cut. There's lots of concern that actually they'd rather pay more rent and get more services and more houses delivered. So it doesn't seem to be that the government is at the moment focusing on supply. Fixing this country's housing problems is actually a massive issue and a challenge that's going to go on for longer than one single parliament. But we need a government to be bold and challenge the desire to have ever-rising house prices. It's absolutely fine to have people aspiring to own, and actually having assets is really good for individuals in many ways. But those massive unearned, untaxed gains that go to the individual and aren't able to be shared to help other people come up behind you is a real loss. And it would be brilliant to have the government looking at that issue, which really promotes what you might call intergenerational or intertenure inequality, to just try and level the playing field out so everybody gets a chance at a decent quality housing experience rather than just the selected few that benefit at the moment. It's quite hard to unpick what the impacts are going to be, particularly from the budget yesterday, because there are different pressures coming on social housing. But we can see the right to buy coming forwards, which I'm sure lots of people will jump at the chance to buy, which will reduce stock and therefore will need to be rebuilt and replaced. So that's one challenge. Hopefully we'll get one for one replacement. That's what the government's promised.
Well, some people will say this is a bit like free money, because people will be getting a subsidised home. They won't be paying a market price for that house.
No, and the discounts are massive for people who've been tenants for many years. The discounts are beyond the dreams of most other people who might have got other kinds of help to buy their own property. So that's one pressure. The rents in social housing have been cut, and the higher earning or slightly higher earning tenants are being asked to pay a market rent, which presumably might push people to leave property. So it's hard to see what's going to happen and what the patterns are going to be in future. But what's clear is that there is a lot of pressure on social housing. The government is trying to make it a temporary emergency tenure, whereas if you look at the local authorities and the philanthropists who set the movement up 100 years ago, that was not actually their aim. It was meant to be a more open, more inclusive, more positive type of housing. And I think the idea of an American-style welfare model where people struggle, get helped out by the church and move on after 2 years is not the society that a lot of tenants who are active with TPAS are wanting to see.
I think of the prefabs, post-war prefabs, as temporary housing, you know, but actually the social housing should be there, possibly, at least the idea was, for life if necessary.
Yeah, and lots of people have really valued that opportunity for life, or at least to raise their children and give them a safe start in life. So lots of landlords have actually stopped offering lifetime tenancies anyway in recent years, but have guaranteed that people can live there as long as they need it, which changes how secure people feel. And if we see further attacks on that, I think people will feel much more vulnerable. And we don't need this race to the bottom. We hear a lot about how tenants in the private rented sector don't feel safe and don't feel in control, and just because that is the case for everyone who rents in the private sector, there's no need to reduce social housing to that standard. Surely the aspiration to bring private sector up to being more secure and more attractive to people.
That's one of the take-homes I get from Abigail Davis there, Martin Summers, is this whole idea of social housing. The idea is you've got an assured tenancy. No one's going to evict you. What she's saying there is the move is the other way around, that actually this is only going to be temporary housing.
Yeah, well, I'll perhaps take a bit of a tangent on this, because, of course, one of the problems with the housing policy that we've had in this country for generations is the macroeconomic implications of it. Because we've been obsessed with home ownership to the extent of subsidising it in certain sections of the population, so, for example, selling off housing association stock, you get a situation where the cost of housing is higher than it would otherwise be. And that then, and you also get property bubbles, which is we're right in the middle of another property bubble yet again, which I've seen several in my lifetime. And of course, in other countries in Europe, they don't run it like that. They don't run it like that at all. And they actually recognise that you have massive changes in housing prices as property bubbles rise and fall, and people have to pay a large proportion of their income as rent, for example, that undermines the competitiveness of your
export industries.
So
why are they doing it?
Because it's social engineering. In the 1920s, the conservative governments in the 1920s decided what they needed to do to get rid of the threat of Bolshevism or whatever was to encourage people to own their own homes through tax and other incentives. And it's actually social engineering to kind of the idea that people should own their own homes. I mean, George Osborne yesterday was talking about people not getting on the housing ladder. And I've got news for him. About a third of the population have no prospect of getting on the housing ladder, never did, never will. So the housing ladder, which the Chancellor is trying to improve, although of course in many ways it's not going to improve anything, because I think the policies are not going to succeed, is still an obsession of, it's a political obsession, and it undermines, in fact, Britain's export competitiveness in international markets.
Anthony?
Yeah, I find myself agreeing quite a lot of that, but I do think there's a genuine aspiration of a lot of people to own their own homes. I think it's seen as a sign of personal status. I don't mean, you know, outward status, but personal well-being mm-hmm. type status. So I wouldn't agree with that necessarily. I don't think it's that engineered. I think it's certainly picked up on what is out there and has tried to push it towards a political statement. That's certainly what Mrs. Thatcher was certainly trying to do when she first started the process. But it is getting out of control. In Bristol, we do have our housing stock. We have 28,000 social houses in social properties in Bristol, and we have only a couple of years ago made sure that anybody can remain in their house forever. It's renewed every 5 years, but that's just a process of making sure that we can just keep it ticking over. But everybody has the right to remain in the house all the time. And it looks to me, you're quite right, as if that is going to be nationally taken away.
Well, I mean, it's one of those fundamental things, isn't it, about the threat of eviction from where you are. I don't think it's actually productive for anybody to be under the threat of eviction, because, you know, what you're doing is you're then not looking after the property. If you're being threatened with eviction, a lot of private landlords' properties just simply don't get looked after, because there's no sense of permanence. And also, it makes it very difficult for families to plan for the future when they're not sure whether they're going to be hoofed out onto the street.
Well, the private renter sector is very different to the social renter sector in that respect, because the way that works is that tenants in the private renter sector have now a very, very... most of them are under short-hold tenancies. The only control on maintenance is frankly them being charged if there's anything slightly wrong with the property when it's handed back. That the maintenance is not one of the major considerations. In the social renter sector in Bristol, we have a massive maintenance program that's going on all the time to make sure we maintain and even raise the standards of what we call relet properties, so that when someone moves out, we then put in a squad to raise the quality of that, so that the person coming in starts off well, much better than the property was in the first place. So that there's a different ethos here, and I think that has to be understood.
It seems to me almost, Martin, that the poor and the homeless, there's no political party that's sticking up for them and it's promising to build them a home, make sure they've got a roof over their head, as there actually was from the Conservatives in the 1950s.
Well, the Conservatives built the most council houses in Britain in the 1950s, because that was there was a general consensus about this, which has been eroded away over a generation. And I think the real problem is that the people who are on the receiving end of the problems with homelessness and difficulties to find anywhere stable to live, the political system doesn't work in their favour. We've got less people registered to vote at this election than the previous election, because the registration forms were changed, so that it was individual registration instead of household registration. And of course the...
Well, if I could just come in on that, because we asked for one of these registration forms at home, spoke to the council, someone at the council, nothing ever arrived.
Well, we know that in Bristol West, for example, the population has increased, but there are less people registered to vote this time than last time, and that's pretty much the same all over the country. And also, of course, the electoral system without pre-R means that it's the political battle is won in places like Nuneaton and Basildon, and those people are not necessarily the people who are most disadvantaged in terms of housing. So the by disadvantaging a large proportion of the population in terms of housing, they are disenfranchised by the political system as well. It's almost like householder voting, which we used to have. In Northern Ireland right up into the 1960s, you had to be a head of household to vote. And we're actually getting back to that kind of political system, I'm afraid.
Anyway, just looking a bit more closely at the budget, George Osborne's benefit cuts are set to make 13 million families significantly worse off. Now, this is the Institute for Fiscal Studies that reported the day after the budget. Pretty shocking stuff. And I was pretty annoyed that the major broadcasters, including the BBC, didn't really pick up on this at all on the day until the IFS had done their job for them. Anthony, what are your thoughts about the accuracy and the figures here? 13 million families, all of them, the lower, already not very well off, are going to be significantly worse off, according to the IFS.
Well, the IFS is meant to be independent, so I think I'd be more inclined to listen to what they had to say than any politician, frankly, from almost any party. It's interesting that I hope you're not going to ask me to comment on these things, because I really believe these things need to bed down. It depends. If you talk about headlines figures, one side or the other, it's very easy to argue that one. But if you wait for the understanding of what's behind the headline figures, you know, for example, George Osborne saying that there's going to be a national living wage which is going to be imposed, is that going to work very quickly? Is all his tax and national insurance palliatives going to make that more easy to deliver? Are we going to actually lose a lot of people, more than the 60,000 or even that number that the IFS suggests, from having jobs? How will it all work out in the end? I remember, as a parallel, when lots of cuts were made in Westminster and local authorities under the cuts previously, the Chancellor then said that they would be creating three times as many jobs in the private sector, and everybody said that was absolutely impossible. In fact, it turned out to be 10 times as many jobs. So we've got to wait until this beds down. The principle, we've got to understand the principles of this. Do we really want people earning good salaries and less people being on benefits? Yeah, I think we do. If this if this is a way of achieving that over time, or if it's a starting making that happen over time, then I'm for it. But at the moment, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not convinced by the figures, and I prefer to accept what the IFS is telling me.
Yeah, a lot of this, Martin, it seems, is coming from taking away working tax credits from people who are in work, which seems bizarre to me. You know, this is one of the things that you actually desperately need in order to make work pay. You know, that was what we were told originally. So what do you make of all this, Martin?
Well, I tend to agree with Anthony. I think that the IFS generally are independent, and they've basically done crunch the figures, and a lot of people are going to be worse off.
What about the bigger picture, though? Because I can remember back in 2010, when the coalition was first formed, we had a message from George Osborne saying, I'm going to balance the books by 2015. That's this year. Again, he's actually kicked in this emergency budget. The date is going to balance the books back another year. So it's now 2019.
Yes, well, in a way, that's quite sensible.
Every budget, it's announced that the books are going to be balanced in 4 years' time.
Well, to be honest with you, what he did last time was lie and said he was going to do it in one term, and of course they couldn't do it in one term, and as the election came closer, they allowed the deficit to increase so that the economy didn't collapse. And of course,
when is he going to balance?
I want to make the fundamental point that you don't want to cut the deficit because you can make the economy collapse. With what's going on in China and what's going on in Greece this week, the last thing you need to do is have an ideologically driven attempt to cut the budget deficit in Britain. So, in a sense, Osborne is being canny by kicking the can up the road, and I would agree with that as a sensible policy. But on the other hand, of course, underlying all of this is that we've had 5 years of zero interest rates all over the world, quantitative easing in Japan, quantitative easing in the United States of America, probably quantitative easing in the European zone soon, and the economy is still spluttering. There's a real possibility the banks are still insolvent. They are still insolvent. That's why RBS will have to be sold, if it's going to be sold, for less than was paid for by the government when they bought it at the beginning of the crisis.
Another deadline for Greece as well this week.
Well, that's another story, obviously. We were talking about British. But the point is that what's happening in Greece, where we're watching people queuing up outside banks and the ATMs are not giving them the money, and saying, gosh, isn't it awful what's happening with Greece? If Greece leaves the Eurozone in a disorderly fashion, Deutsche Bank will collapse. Deutsche Bank will pull down HSBC, and Osborne will not be talking about cutting benefits or increasing benefits or anything. It'll be all hands on deck for another emergency.
So do you think that they are going to stay in the Eurozone then?
No, I think they're going to leave the Eurozone in a disorderly fashion, and Deutsche Bank will collapse.
What, at the weekend?
Which could happen in the next 10 days. The stock market in China has fallen by 30% in the last 10 days. There's absolute panic on deck over there. That's going to affect everything.
How is it going to affect us here?
The banking system is absolutely interrelated, and Britain is at the centre of the international banking system. So if Deutsche Bank collapses, it will pull down the major banks in the City of London, and George Osborne will either have to get the money out to bail them out or let them collapse.
Well, surely the Germans are saying to the Greeks at the moment, they're saying, well, actually, we're not going to bail you out unless you do a restructuring plan. And it looks like they may be agreeing to that at the weekend.
They may, but the fact of the matter, as Varoufakis pointed out, the finance minister, is we can't pay under any circumstances. So no matter what you say, one way or the other, you cannot get blood out of a stone. And the Greeks will not be able to pay if they are forced into an austerity straitjacket. And of course, that then means they will leave the Eurozone in a disorderly fashion. Deutsche Bank collapses and so on.
Now, Anthony, Greece is a long way from Bristol, apart from on EasyJet. But do you think that this is going to affect us here?
Well, yes, I think it probably will affect us here. I think the ripples of this are going to be last for a generation. But I think what wasn't said there was how close Britain was to the Greek situation. Mm. The fact that we are now considering about going along with what the coalition, which is my part of the coalition, was trying to soften sweeten some of the medicine, and it's now been agreed that the pace of that deficit removal will now be as was in the coalition's time. So George Osborne has grasped that fact. The fact was that when we started this process in 2010, we were not that far away from the Greek situation, and in terms of personal debt, probably worse. And it was a desperately serious situation to find ourselves in. And I think what we've managed to do over the last 5 years, and I hope that some of the measures are going to make sure that we can continue to pull ourselves out of this were absolutely necessary, and we've managed to do something that the Greeks have not. But as has just been said, it's still pretty fragile in this country.
I was watching one of the TV channels during the week, and one of the reporters was trying to pay for things in drachmas in Greece, and it was getting quite a good response and humorous response from a lot of the cafe owners and things like that, who were surprised to see the drachmas. And he's saying, well, hang on, this is, it says Grexit here. But anyway, I rather like that approach. And in fact, I think that for many countries, and I wonder what you think about this, Anthony, is that they think unless they've got their own currency, they don't really control their own society. And there's an element of sovereignty here.
Right. I have to say that one of the principal reasons that I became a liberal many, many years ago was because of Europe. I felt very strongly about Europe for all the very high-level reasons that Europe, I think, is still a very good idea.
But yet the euro is falling apart now.
Okay. As soon as you start working that through into nuts and bolts and everything else, then you do lose that local energy. But that it's been that local factionalism in the past in Europe, and I'm thinking the last 300-400 years that Europe has been at each, you know, different factions have been at each other's throat regularly. And I think some softening of that. It seems to me that the euro has worked up until perhaps the last 10 years. It was actually a fairly solid base for continuing. It started to fracture, and the problem is as soon as things start going wrong, that is when you find out whether or not you've got a system that works.
Okay, now I'd like to just bring in Christine Townsend, education expert. Hi, Christine. Welcome.
Hello.
To the Pologic Show. Now, I know you've been looking at some rather naughty, nefarious, and actually even illegal activity by some of our schools in the city.
Yeah, well, this goes back a couple of years now, back to the summer of 2013. And I first became interested in this when the Bristol Cathedral Choir School announced in the press that they'd quite like to have the basement of our central library to move their free school primary into. And I've worked in state education for the best part of 20 years now. I worked at the City Academy in Bristol since 2003. Then I moved on to work at the City of Bristol College down on College Green. So for 2 years leading up to this announcement, I'd been walking past the Cathedral Choir School and kind of just noting how different it was to the City Academy, which is where I'd come from. And I'd also done a bit of work up at the Orchard School. And so I started to look to see who is it that this primary school is actually going to allocate their places to, because, of course, we have a primary school place crisis. We did then. I think we're just about getting over it now, although it's going to move into the secondary sector. And it became quite clear that this school was not only was it not going to serve the children that lived in Cabot, which was known to need places, it was going to allocate places to children across Bristol, across North Somerset and across South Gloucestershire. And that was exactly how their secondary school had been allocating its places since it became a state academy. So, and I asked questions of senior education officers, and pretty much what I got back were bland statements around how everything was fine, Christine, and don't worry about it. And so I referred both of those schools around Christmas time of 2013. Both of those came back with unlawful admission arrangements. They were ordered to make changes.
So, okay. So what was actually wrong with their admission arrangements?
Well, they weren't following the parts of the law. I mean, the admissions code is about 100 pages long. It's very, very complicated.
So what were they doing wrong then?
Some of it was the language, the way in which they presented their admissions arrangements. But the big one for the cathedral school was that they were the way that they were testing for their music places actually was outlawed within admissions code, because what they were doing was testing how good somebody was at something as opposed to how musical they were. Because there's a difference, because if you can get your child as they're as they're growing up to take lots and lots of music lessons, of course you're gonna pass the test better than a child that isn't in that position. And what that then becomes, of course, when those children get those places, that is actually social selection. And so that got the attention of the British Humanist Society, which has got something called the Fair Admissions Campaign. And then that summer they then referred Church of England School, St Mary Redcliffe and Temple, very popular school. You can walk from it from here, can't you, out in Redcliffe. They also had a look at St Bernadette's, which is the Catholic school down in the south, and they re-looked at Bristol Cathedral Choir School, and they thought, actually, do you know what, it's still not within the law. So they referred those three again that summer. All three came back ordering changes because, again, it had been they'd been operating outside the law. And more recently, the North Bristol Post 16 Centre has also been investigated. Now, these are national investigations. This is an external agency that comes into the city and has a look at what is actually and how these institutions are allocating their places. So the North Bristol Post 16 Centre, that was also found to be admitting students outside the law, and that's run by, it's a joint run by Redland Green and Colston Girls School.
How do we fix this? Because, I mean, everything's moved away from local authority control. Many more of these schools are managed by central government now, aren't they?
Well, this is true, but there's also a myth around this, and it seems to be elevated and escalated in Bristol somehow, that actually these are academies and therefore there's nothing that the local authority can do about it. The local authority has a legal obligation to report any admissions arrangements that they consider to be unlawful. It's actually in the code that that's what they must do. And so either senior officers in the education authority aren't bothering to look, or there isn't the expertise within the authority, within the our education department, that actually understands how it is that admissions arrangements work and what is and what isn't lawful.
But surely, I mean, parents have been moving close to schools to get their kids in there for donkey's years.
Yes, absolutely. Redland Green is a prime example of that because they use closest distance, and the house prices apparently around Redland Green have gone massively up as a result of people, you know, and the catchment area has reduced because it's about distance. But this is one of the arguments that's used both by Cathedral Primary School and the secondary school. When I met with Neil Blundell, he said, well, isn't that a problem, Christine, that, you know, parents can't move closer to the school to get their kids into that school? And it was kind of, well, actually, do you know what, if you live in Yate or if you live in Clevedon and you can't get your child into that school, you're not going anyway, so what difference does it make? If you live in Avonmouth and you don't have the funds to get your child to the school, you're not going, so what's the difference, Neil?
Amazing. Anyway, Anthony Negus, I wonder what you make of this, because there have been big changes in the last 10 years with education, and it does seem as if there's a kind of fragmentation of the system where one school behaving in one way, another school, maybe a free school, behaving in another way. And there's also the other aspect of all of this is that Ofsted doesn't always target the schools, particularly brand new academy schools, which are having problems, but for political reasons they don't want to cause trouble for a school after it's just started sometimes. So anyway, what are your thoughts about the way education's gone recently?
Well, it certainly is fragmented, and I think that's I think that has lots of problems. The council used to have a regulatory control of all schools, and that was a way of binding it together, and certainly in terms of maintaining standards. We also have a supply service to schools of all of all natures. So we do, in those two respects, we do keep, we do maintain some sort of finger in the pie. But I do believe that our ability to influence this and maintain standards across the board is very much diminished. It is a system that's all over the place at the moment.
Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about what can we do to actually start to regularise this so that there is a, you know, what the worst aspect of this, it seems to me, is that you've got a kind of ghettoisation with some schools taking kids from poor areas and not producing results, and other schools taking kids from rich areas who are massively advantaged over those poorer schools. And also we're in this weird situation now where former public schools are now being paid for by the state.
Well, my father was actually the youngest headmaster in Britain in 1956, and he took early retirement from the state education system in the 1980s when they brought in the idea of parental choice with the money moving with the children. He was willing to accept the idea of parental choice, although it's actually not the cheapest way of doing things. You should basically go to the local school, would have been his opinion. But once you move the children, the money moves with the children, you then get successful schools and sink schools. What he tried to argue for in that period was that you can have separate schools and choice amongst the schools. You can go to the popular school with 30 in the class or the unpopular school with 15 in the class. And as a teacher, he said, over time, the results will measure out. All teachers know it's about bodies in the classroom in terms of results. And of course, that's not what happened. And therefore, of course, we've now got a very, very unfair system where the privileges that people used to be able to buy with their pocketbooks are now being paid for by the taxpayer. And of course, the problems of schools with, you know, with difficult intakes and people and children with problems are brushed under the carpet, because we're only interested, really, of course, in league tables and so on. And an awful lot of what schools like the one I work with are doing is dealing with children's emotional problems because of the difficulties that they face. And that's not actually recognised by the system.
Well, I see you nodding there, Christine. How do we fix it? I mean, I'm obviously, you know, it's going to be no quick fix, but what should we be doing as a society to make our schools work for parents and children?
I mean, I think I agree with Anthony to some extent that actually the local authorities need to take back that kind of strategic role. Schools are not islands. And what's happened, and I think this is particularly emphasised in Bristol, actually, because of our particular history of secondary education, is that some schools consider themselves to be islands and they can do whatever it is that they like. What I would say about the admissions code, that because it recently changed December 2014, every school is now in a position to prioritise children that are entitled to pupil premium, which includes children on free school meals. Now, if we had a policy in this city that said, you must, in your arrangements, or we're going to lobby you and we're going to put into your consultation and we're going to ask every school in this city to prioritise children on free school meals, I think we'd see a very different intake going on. Because Redland Green, okay, he's got the smallest free school meal number in the city of 4%, but if you lived within 3 miles of Redland Green and you can walk to school, because that's the statutory walking distance, if you were entitled to a free school meal, you would go to the top of the list to get in that place. And what we would see is a lot more is that kind of social selection evened out across our state sector. And this is particularly prevalent, this social selection, in our secondary sector, because City Academy's got over 60% of their children entitled to free school meals. St Mary Redcliffe has got 7%, and they're within walking distance.
Amazing. Anyway, Christine Townsend, thanks very much for joining us. On to another story now, and we're going to go to Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, where Rysa Pearce was asking about the poor conditions for 1 million of our elderly people, the way they're being left now.
Rysa Pearce!
Yeah, yeah.
What does the Prime Minister have to say in response to new figures from Age UK showing there are over 1 million elderly people in this country who are not getting the basic help they need to be washed, dressed or fed?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we need to see a continued improvement in social care in our country, and we need to continue to help pensioners in our country. And pensioner poverty is at an all-time low in our country because this party has kept its promises to uprate the basic state pension, to support the pensioners' benefits, and to make sure people have dignity in their old age.
Well, that would be nice if it was working, but apparently a million elderly people, Martin, not washed or dressed or fed properly.
Well, I think we had this situation in Bristol a few years ago, did we not, where the in-house home helps who were paid £9 an hour by the council were let go, and it was privatised to the private sector where people were paid a lot less. And of course, the time given by the private sector to carry out these tasks is often 15 minutes for a visit.
That was
not
the thing. Was your administration, Anthony, wasn't it?
It was, but that's not a very good characterisation of what actually happened.
Well, would you like to answer the point that the lady made in the Commons there about elderly people not being looked after properly nowadays?
I think there are a lot of elderly people that have a very poor level of service. But that, I think, is to do with the way that the inbuilt ability to regulate the system is made to work. It isn't simply a case of saying the way that the contracts were and the price that individuals were being paid to do it necessarily guarantee that there was a better level of service. I think we should look at what the situation was before and review where we are afterwards, and I'm sure that's something that one of the other scrutiny commissions is going to have on their agenda.
Well, you were talking earlier on about bringing waste collection back in-house. I mean, surely the whole point of farming these out to contractors is that the council can hold its hands up and say nothing to do with us, Gov.
The waste contract is actually a very successful reversion, as it were, because we had such a very good contract which said exactly what the waste contractor had to do. And since the contractor has not been doing that, it was possible then to put pressure on that waste contractor and for him actually to offer a very good arrangement whereby we actually took it back and put it back together again and sent it back out to somebody
else. Didn't the waste contractor Mayguernie go bust and then it got taken over by Kier? But yeah, we still see all these Mayguernie lorries and things going around the streets. Anyway, probably a good idea to move on to some couple stories before the news at 6. Bristol Water must cut bills, says the regulator. A water company serving 1.2 million customers, that's us folks, has been told it must cut household prices after it rejected an earlier ruling by the regulator. Ofwat had told Bristol Water to cut bills by 19% before inflation over 2015 to 2020. The firm challenged the order. Bristol Water rejects it. Now, what annoys me about this, Anthony, is you've got our high water bills we're paying here, far too high, say Ofwat, being used to pay lawyers to say, no, we want to carry on overcharging people.
If we have a regulatory system, which we do for all of these so-called providers, it used to be called statutory providers, then that regulatory system ought to be allowed to make independent decisions and be in a position to enforce them. If there is overcharging, then it should be accepted. That's the regulator's role, to carry out an investigation and make a judgment, and then that should follow through. It doesn't appear that's happening in this case. It's simply being challenged and challenged and challenged.
Martin, it seems we've got the worst water company in the country in Bristol Water, overcharging more than anywhere else. And also, not only that, Ofwat are saying they're the only company that's illegally challenged it, saying we don't want to decrease our bills at all.
Well, at the sake of sounding like a stuck record, in Scotland, the Scottish Water Company is owned by the Scottish Government as one provider, and they basically run it, and that is the way we used to run things in the rest of the country.
Also, news of the Chief Constable Nick Gargan this week. Sorry, he is, for the misconduct, and he's pleased his suspension is over. Police Chief Nick Gargan has apologised after being found guilty of 8 charges of misconduct. The top cop said he accepted the findings of the panel and was relieved that his suspension had been lifted, but not gross misconduct, Anthony.
No, I'm unclear as to exactly what that means, but certainly the gross misconduct charges were not found, were not sustained, so he can keep his job because it's only the gross misconduct which requires him to be sacked. I question whether or not this would have happened in a situation where we would have had police authorities, elected police authorities, where we had a wide range of people, individuals and local politicians, who were able to have some very wise heads and looking at the way this ran, rather than a single elected police and crime commissioner. I think that's a far too focused and personalised way of doing things, and I feel the same way about the mayoral system as well.
Yeah, so you don't think it's really working, the police and crime commissioner with the chief constable and the senior police?
No, I don't, and I think that where there's been opportunities to review this, those positions have been seriously questioned, wanting.
Up for re-election next year, I think Sue Mount-Stevens will
so.
Be.
I believe so.
Martin, what do you make about the chief constable coming back? Anthony was saying before we started the programme, he's actually been on suspension with full pay for longer than he's actually been doing the job.
Well, I agree with Anthony that we shouldn't have police and crime commissioners. Very silly idea from the get-go. But again, one of the legacies of the last coalition government.
OK, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus, also to education expert Christine Townsend. After the Murdoch News, we take a longer view tonight of the rise of the police state.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.